We're talking last week a series on an evil heart of unbelief. We talked a good bit about the heart of which we are speaking. As we mentioned a little bit in class this morning, the word heart in the Bible almost, not quite, but almost always is referring to the inner man, the seat of intellect, the seat of emotion, the seat of the conscience, and the seat of the will. The inner man is designed so as to be like God. All these things are true of God. They are true of us. Us being created in the image of God has nothing to do with what we look like on the outside, but what we are capable of on the inside. And yet many people develop an evil heart of unbelief. And we talked last week about the fact that the heart is a treasure chest. Men will have good things and or evil things in their heart, and it is that is what determines their actions, whether they have more good or more evil things in their heart. And so we want to talk about a little bit more about an evil heart of unbelief before we move to the causes of an evil heart of unbelief. Now, we need to understand that belief and unbelief can coexist within a single heart. If this were not true, there would be no growing in our faith. As we grow in faith, our unbelief diminishes, and by unbelief, we usually use the word doubt. Doubt and faith can coexist. One may possess doctrinal belief and practical unbelief. We talked a little bit about that last week based on Hebrews 11:6. Without faith, it's impossible to please God, for he that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is the rewarder of those who diligently seek him. If a man believes these two things, then he will diligently seek God. And so there's the doctrinal belief, believing that God is. Then there's the practical belief, believing that God is the rewarder of those that diligently seek him, which results in an individual diligently seeking God. But we want to notice a passage in Mark chapter 9, 14 through 16, and some other passages in that same context. We'll also be looking at a passage in Matthew's parallel to this, where we see an individual who had belief and he had unbelief. Mark 9:14, and when he came to the disciples, he saw a great multitude around them and scribes disputing with them. Immediately when they saw him, all the people were greatly amazed, and running to him, greeted him, and he asked the scribes, "What are you discussing with them?" Now the scribes were men who excelled in their writing skills, and they were the men who were responsible for copying Old Testament texts. They also would copy the written traditions of the elders. They were the official writers connected with the religion that God had given to the Jews, or true religion as it was in that time, although it had been perverted. So Jesus, his disciples had presented him this particular location, and the scribes had engaged or were disputing with his disciples. And so here Jesus comes, and of course they all go over to him because he's the one that's over the disciples. And Jesus asked them, saying, "What are you discussing with them?" That is, with my disciples. Then one of the crowd answered and said, "Teacher, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit." Now, a mute spirit is a demon, or was a demon, that would be primarily focused on the speech capabilities of the person and who he possessed. Now, without getting into a long discussion of this, the demons were the angels who sinned before the beginning of the creation, before the beginning of the physical creation. They sinned against God. and God had cast them down to Tartarus.
According to 2 Peter chapter 2 and the book of Jude.
These angels who had sinned were Satan's angels,
the devil's angels. You might remember that in Matthew chapter 25, verse 42, I believe it is, Jesus will tell some after judgment, depart ye into everlasting fire prepared for the devil and his angels. The devil was once an angelic being, but he rebelled against God, and so many angels, we don't know how many, followed him in his rebellion. These angels were given some freedom during the latter part of the period covered in the minor prophets of Zechariah and Malachi, and during the period of the Gospels, and during the early period of the church. These demons were allowed out of Tartarus. They were allowed to possess people by allowed. That simply means God made it possible for them to do so. He was not pleased with it, but they were able to do so. I believe that God did that so that his son and his son's apostles and certain others of his son's disciples could demonstrate a greater power by casting these demons out. And so Jesus would command, and the apostles later and certain others had the authority to command these demons to leave the person whom they had possessed. Again, some of these demons would concentrate on the speech faculty, preventing the individual from speaking. Some of them would interfere with the hearing process so that they couldn't hear. And there were other bodily functions or bodily parts and senses that these demons would interfere with. And so this was a new spirit. His primary focus was preventing this son, this young man. We don't know how old he was, but he was a young man. He was not a boy, because he mentioned since he was a boy, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But he was preventing him from being able to speak, and so he was called a mute spirit. So Peter, I brought you my son who has a mute spirit, and wherever it seizes him, it throws him down. He foams at the mouth, gnashes his teeth, and becomes rigid. So I spoke to your disciples that they could cast it out, but they could not. So he had come to the disciples who again had received Jesus in this location and said, look, my son has a mute spirit. He's possessed by this spirit who has primarily been focusing on his speech capacity, but he's always also doing these other things. And it was a terrible thing for this to happen to anybody, and I'm not sure if I fully understand why some and not others, unless some are more susceptible to that than others. So that's another story. But he wants the demon gone, and he heard of Jesus and the apostles being able to cast out demons, and so he brings his son to the disciples, please cast out the demon, cast this new spirit out of my son. So they could not. In other words, they had commanded the spirit to leave, and the spirit was particularly belligerent and obstinate and would not leave. We'll talk more about that in a second. He answered, Jesus did, and said, O faithless generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you? Bring him to me. Then they brought him to him, the son. And when he saw him, that is when the son saw Jesus, immediately the spirit convulsed him, and he fell on the ground and wallowed, foaming at the mouth. Now this is commonly referred to as today as epilepsy. I don't think demons are responsible for epilepsy. I don't believe demons have the same power today that they did in the first century. But they did have the power in the first century. Now these demons always recognized who Jesus was.
And they never were so belligerent that they refused to leave a part of whom they had possessed once Jesus commanded them to do so. So he asked his father, how long has this been happening to him? And he said, from childhood. So obviously he was no longer in his childhood. He has appeared somewhat, or perhaps in his adolescence, or maybe he was even a young adult. But since his childhood, and often he has thrown him, that is the demon, has thrown him both into the fire and into the waters to destroy him. These demons were not set on anything good. They had evil purposes. Again, this one primarily focusing on his speech, but also causing these other things. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. Notice that there is an element of doubt here. He says, if you can do anything, have compassion on us. And I can understand why you might think that Jesus wasn't able to look, because the disciples weren't able to do it. So his faith has been checking a little bit. But he goes on. Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. In other words, the if does not lie with Jesus. Jesus can't. The if lies with man. If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. And then the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. So he was a believer. He did believe, but he was also in some sense an unbeliever. He had some unbelief there. So belief and unbelief can coexist in the same heart. And again, He had just asked the disciples on the previous slide to do something, and they could not. So there's another little doubt here. But he believes that Jesus can. But again, there's that element of doubt. Help my unbelief. Now over in Matthew, Jesus did cast them out, by the way. In Matthew 17:19-21, then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, why can we not cast it out? So Jesus said to them, because of your unbelief. Now the Father confessed a measure of unbelief, but now Jesus charges his disciples with a measure of unbelief. Because of your unbelief, for surely I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move, and nothing will be impossible for you. However, this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting. What he says, by the way, the mountain here, I don't believe he's talking about a physical mountain, I believe he's talking about a metaphorical mountain, a mountainous problem. You can deal with it if you have faith grain of mustard. And most of the time they did. But there were times when their faith wavered. This was one of those times. What was the problem? They had not been praying and fasting like they needed to, and prayer and fasting would have built up their faith, their confidence, and the Spirit would not have been so belligerent. But this was a particularly stubborn spirit. He said, this kind does not go out except by prayer, but not the Spirit, not the demon's prayer fast. It was the prayer and fasting on the part of the apostles. They needed to do that in order to strengthen. But right now, let me just say here that there is no command in the New Testament for Christians to fast. Although there are many statements that seem to assume that Christians will. And fasting is never done, and never mentioned in the scriptures in connection with an effort to lose weight. It's always in connection with some spiritual matter. In other words, here's in a case where we normally we would be eating right now, but here's somebody we need to pray for. Here's somebody we need to visit. We need to help out. And so you take that opportunity instead of eating and feeding your body, you feed your soul, your spirit, by helping somebody else. And so prayer is almost always connected by fasting. And so, were the disciples unbelievers? Not in the strict sense, not in the doctrinal sense.
But in the practical sense, on this occasion, even his disciples were
not absolutely lacking, but deficient in their faith. They did not have enough faith to give them the confidence to, as a matter of fact, in my Facebook this morning, if you read that article, if you haven't already, it talks about how that,
after the apostles were arrested, Peter and John were arrested and let loose, they went back to the apostles and told them what had happened, and they all prayed. And there was another miraculous event there, and it gave them the confidence that they had been praying for.
So that's what I believe he's talking about here. If you were praying and fasting like that, you would have a greater faith, and therefore you could speak with greater confidence, greater authority, and they wouldn't be so stubborn. But he was not so stubborn, he wouldn't listen to Jesus. Jesus cast him out. So an evil heart of unbelief is a heart that is indifferent to some extent to what God wants done. Now the disciples did not have evil hearts of unbelief.
But there was a practical unbelief there, a deficiency of faith based on their lack or insufficiency of faith,
fasting and praying. So we're talking about an evil heart, that's a heart filled with evil. An evil heart of unbelief is the particular form that evil takes. Unbelief has overtaken the heart so that there's very little, if any, faith left. And so instead of a person feeding their faith,
they begin to feed their doubt. And instead of their faith growing, their faith atrophies. We all know people like that. They began having doubts, they began having questions, and asking all the wrong questions. You never get an answer that will satisfy you. And your faith dwindles. It's atrophies. And your unbelief grows and grows and grows until
you just got any more of unbelief, and it's all there is to it. So that's what we're talking about. A heart that is indifferent to what God wants done because of the evil thing that exists within it. It has no intention, this heart, of obeying God. Again, I'm not saying that was true of the apostles. They did not have an evil heart of unbelief, but there was a deficiency of faith there. And there's a difference between a deficiency of faith and an absence of faith. In 1 Corinthians 10, by the way, remember we talked last week about Hebrews chapter 3, and what was the writer speaking of in Hebrews chapter 3? He was speaking about the movement of the Israelites from Egypt to Canaan. And what was initially to be just a short trip became a 40-year trip because of the obstinacy of the people. There were 12 tribes that sent into the land to spy it out. They came back, and 10 of those spies said, you know, there's just no way we can take this land. But Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, said, we can take it because God's going to be with us. But the people listened to the 10 rather than to the 2. And God, they weren't going to go in. So God said, all right, you're going to wander in the wilderness 1 year for every day the spies spent in the land. And they spent 40 days in the land. So they were going to wander 40 years in the wilderness. Then they said, okay, well, go in. You're not too late now.
It's too late now. You're not showing your true colors.
Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 is talking about that same period of time, the wilderness wandering of 40 years, but Paul breaks it down here into several instances where we get a feel, a better feel, for their aspect of their practical unbelief. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud of the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink. So they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now this is not introducing the reason for which God was not well pleased. This is explanatory of how we know God was not well pleased. How do we know God was not well pleased with us? Well, their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. That's how we know that God was displeased with us. Why was God displeased with us? Because of their disobedience. So first their disobedience or practical unbelief, then God not being pleased with them, then their bodies being scattered in the wilderness. Paul goes on to explain this scattered. By the way, they were all saved. Oh, they had all escaped the bondage of the study. And that's the point he's making. They were all in a right relationship with God. I'm in verse 6 and 7. Now these things became our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted, and did not become idolaters as were some of them. So, what were the forms of unbelief? Well, one form of that unbelief was lusting after evil things. Now, the fact that they lusted after evil things didn't mean that they no longer believed in God. You mean that? Well, yeah, I believe in God. But it was just the opposite of the behavior God expected. And so it's practical unbelief, one form of that, rather than doctrinal unbelief. And did not become idolaters. Some of them were idolaters. They were, while Moses was up on the mountain receiving the Ten Commandments, the first two of which involved idolatry, the people were down at the foot of the mountain, and everyone in particular, gathering up their gold and melting it down and casting a path, and they were worshiping this path when Moses came down. That's another form of unbelief. Then he says, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And that's talking about their idolatrous worship. And that's a quotation from the Old Testament. That's two forms of unbelief. Lusting after evil things and becoming idolaters. He says, nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did. So there was another form of unbelief, practical unbelief back there in the wilderness. And in one day, 23,000 fell. So the bodies were scattered in the wilderness because they were moving around during that 40 years. But on one day, 23,000 fell because of their sexual immorality. That, by the way, is a part of the story of Balaam and Balak. Balak and Balaam. King Balak, he was afraid of Israelites. He did not want to engage them in war. So he was afraid even if he didn't challenge them, if they not challenged him, but he wasn't going to start nothing. He didn't want them to start nothing either. Balaam was a prophet of God. He was not an Israelite. He was a Gentile prophet of God. Whomever he blessed, they were blessed. Whomever he cursed, they were cursed. So Balak tried to hire Balaam to curse Israel. And Balak said, well, I can't do it, but God bless me. So I give you all this money, it doesn't really matter how much money you offer me. I can't do it for God bless you. I will double it. Well, let me see what more the Lord will say. And the Lord gave him permission to go, but certainly did not give him permission to curse the people. And he never was able to curse the people. He told Balaam, you know, if you could somehow influence them, or send somebody over to influence them to engage in idolatry and sexual immorality, God will curse them. He won't be me. And so that's what he's talking about here. 23,000 fell because they gave in to that influence. Nor let us tempt Christ, and some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. That's another account. Jesus mentions that in John chapter 3, as Moses raised up the breaking of the serpent, he can throw them up to the Son of Man being raised up on the cross. And so the serpents came in and bit the people. Why? Because they were testing God. They were testing God. These serpents come in the and started dying, and they go to Moses, please ask God to take the serpents away. And Moses went to God, and God said, no, I ain't taking them away. But you put up a brass serpent, and everybody that looks at that brass serpent will be healed. If they didn't, they'll be healed. There's no problem being healed of something else they already have. But if they've been bitten, when they look at the serpent, they will be healed. They won't die from the snake bite. That's what he's talking about here. Don't be a tempter. Nor complain, as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. And all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. God did not preserve all that just for the Jews alone.
He preserved that so we can get an idea when we go back and study the Old Testament what it means to disobey God. There have been times, such as in Acts chapter 5, when God made an example out of somebody. There was an example about you. And actually, I haven't gotten to Acts chapter 5 yet in my papers of that next week. There was an example about you. They offered unsanctioned fire in their worship of God. God destroyed them with fire. Others just tried to stop the Ark of the Covenant falling off the ox cart. Struck dead. Because obviously don't try to break the sky. An unnamed man just went out on the Sabbath day to pick up sticks. He was violating the Sabbath law. And they put him in hold. So he went and asked God, what am I going to do with it? God just told him. There have been times when God knew that the people needed a lesson about what it meant to disobey God, to displease God. He doesn't always do that. And I don't know that he ever will do that again in time, but he will do it at the end of time. But they happen for our admonition, as our example, and were written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the ages have come. These are aspects of unbelief. Not doctrinal unbelief, but practical unbelief. So here's a person. They believe all the right things. But that's only the intellect, you see. That's only the intellect. Any part is actually wrong. But they don't put these things that they believe into proper application in their lives. So doctrinal belief, practical unbelief.
Next week we're going to talk about what causes an evil heart of unbelief. And there are several causes for an evil heart of unbelief. We're going to look at least one or two of those, if not all of them, next Sunday morning. If you need to make your heart right with God, if you have thus far been a doctrinal unbeliever or a practical unbeliever,
we encourage you to, if you're not an unbeliever, study the Bible. It will, if you study the Bible with objectivity, open mind, open heart, you'll become a believer. The Gospel of John, written primarily to convince people that Jesus was not just a man, but was God. Not God's prophet, but God the Son. Matthew, Mark, and Luke were written for other purposes, but if one studies those books, he will become a believer. And I know that. Because God was responsible for those books. He used men to convey to other men what he wanted men to know so they could believe. And John even pointed out in chapter 20, verse 30, verse 1, these things are written that you might believe, and that believing you might have life.